The Flanacast, a Mike Flanagan recap podcast, covers material that, as is often true within the horror genre, may contain mature themes that are not intended for younger listeners. For specific content warnings pertaining to this episode, please refer to the show notes. Listener discretion is advised. Hello.
Hello there.
Do we not have a new theme song this week?
Hill House. It's a Hill House. They're a really fucked up family.
That was actually really good on the fly, Michelle.
Anyway, now that we're 22 seconds in and we haven't said what you're listening to.
This is the Flanacast.
Welcome to the Flanacast. I am Michelle Macaron.
And I am Dina Grilly, and we are your co-hosts who are going to walk you through Hill House. I'm really excited to do this one.
I mean, this is, for me, I know you came into the Flanafold earlier than I did. You're the OG. But Haunting of Hill House, when it came out in 2018, was the first time that I had really, like, clocked who Mike Flanagan is. So I'm excited that this is like the first thing that we're recapping that I have watched multiple times. And that being said, Dina will still inevitably notice more things than I do.
just because I'm a deep diver, it's just what I do. I was so heavily impacted. Like, this was one of those, you know, life-altering viewings, I think, the first time that I saw it. I do have a video review because it came out in October and I was doing my video reviews for all of the scary stuff I was watching during the month. So I have a video review of the moment I finished watching it where I am a crying mess.
Should we link that in either the show notes for this episode?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to find it. Yeah, I will definitely link it at some point. I feel like it does probably bear sharing, even though
it's like your version of it's your version of Chris Crocker. Like, you're just like, leave Nelly alone. Leave Nelly alone.
Could you imagine? No, I was just I don't even know if I was like, I feel like I thought I was being eloquent about explaining its meaning and significance to me, but I feel like I just did a really bad job of it. Before seeing this version, my real experience with The Haunting of Hill House was the 1999 The Haunting.
Yeah, I know that I have watched that at some point when it was on cable, but I need to rewatch it.
We have to have cocktails and watch it because it is a dumpster fire. But honestly, also, I loved it.
Honestly, we can do a little Instagram live or something and watch that movie. That would be fun. Or a Discord.
I don't know how to use Discord. That's for the young people.
Discord is not for the young people.
It's interesting though, because like when you mention the 1999 The Haunting to someone, they go, like, there's always that sharp intake of breath, except at the same time, there's about 50% of the people go, oh my God, I remember being a young horror fan and like seeing it in the movie theater and loving it. I'm like, I'm in that camp. Mike Flanagan, not in that camp. And rightfully so, right? As an auteur. He shouldn't be liking that movie. I get it.
I think I just loved haunted houses and still love haunted houses, that like anything having to do with like a gothic haunted house I was into. And you had like, I mean, it was queer-coded, but without really knowing it was queer-coded, if I remember correctly. I think it would be interesting to watch it again.
Mm-hmm. It is actually beyond queer-coded. Catherine Zeta-Jones deliberately says she lives with her boyfriend and her girlfriend. And that, like, went way over my head back in 99. Like, you know, baby me didn't really, like, clock it. But, you know, now I'm like, oh, shit. Like, they just really went for it and said it. And even the 67 version?
63.
I'm bad with years,
but
somewhere in there,
somewhere post JFK dying. It's all about JFK.
Wasn't one of ours, it used to be the Titanic as a benchmark of time.
It is. So
there's just something about tragedy and history in us.
It marks us.
Yeah, but even that, I was like watching it, you know, on a rewatch and going, wow, this is way more overtly queer than I remember it being, and like totally here for it. And apparently they cut some stuff out of it that like originally in the 63, 60s version, Theo is leaving her roommate, but like is also breaking up with her. And that scene got cut because it was just too overt.
It was too much.
Mm-hmm. But like they're like snuggling under covers and stuff. And in the book, it's like Shirley Jackson says that she never intended for it to have queer overtones. And if that is true, then she very much failed.
Yeah.
She's so failed.
Maybe Shirley Jackson is the same as my mother, who once told me she didn't know what loving gay men had to do with Cher. So, I mean, maybe we are descended from Shirley Jackson and we just didn't know it.
Well, regardless, I mean, that was my biggest takeaway from reading the book. I had never read the book before, this podcast endeavor. But my takeaway from it was like, oh, wow, what a beautiful, like, kind of like queer star-crossed lover's story in addition to a gothic horror book. Like, I am very taken by the relationship between Theo and Nell in the book. So,
I mean, I am. I think it's a very good gothic novel, but I've realized that sometimes gothic novels, like the narrative in gothic novels, the language for me can be a little florid and a little unclear. But I mean, Hill House is unclear. So,
well, that's the interesting thing. Shirley Jackson apparently had in her mind, and even somewhere on paper, a blueprint of what the house was like on the inside and a very clear vision of the maze-like rooms within the house, and used that while writing, but then also deliberately obscured a lot of the details that would make it clear to the reader. So you are supposed to feel disoriented.
Yeah, the description is pretty good, and then after a while, like I think when they describe the outer level, mm-hmm. you can kind of imagine it, and then when it gets to that the center, the one that has no windows, mm-hmm. it gets a little bit more convoluted.
And then explaining like the veranda wrapping around, and there's all sorts of like different ways in which if you stand in one room, you can see that there's like a turret. And if you stand in another room where you should see it, you don't see it. And she explains like with detail why architecturally you can't see certain spaces from certain windows and such things like that. But then at the same time, you're nodding your head and going, oh, that makes sense. No, it doesn't. So I think she wants you to almost feel like confused, frustrated by the house, all those things that the characters might be experiencing. But yeah, you're right. There's just something in terms of gothic horror where they're trying to create a mood in addition to, you know, a visualization. And so now you've got certain language being used and then it gets too mm-hmm. convoluted. But I mean, it is a short read.
Yeah, that's great. I was going to say that I love that in the book, because in the miniseries, Hill House is really just a house that the Hill family owned, as opposed to in the book, the description of kind of it set in the middle of all of these hills mm-hmm. is very, very visually creepy in that, like, that it feels like you could be kind of like swallowed up at any mm-hmm. given moment is highly effective. I kind of wish that they incorporated that a little bit more into the, mm-hmm. into the miniseries, because I just love that thing of feeling like even more isolated, because there's something scary about being isolated. And, you know, you can name a list 100 haunted houses or murder mystery houses long of like isolation. But there's something about isolation and claustrophobia that mm-hmm. I think is even scarier.
Yeah. And I think that the house that's described both, or the house essentially in both the source material and the series, is what one might consider like a hungry house. You know, mm-hmm. there are like two types of house of haunted houses, and I only remember the Hungry House because I feel like that's the one you see the most. And it's that house that like will suck you in and will rob you of everything inside that is light. And mm-hmm. definitely that idea of like the hills being around the house and surrounding the area in darkness definitely does contribute to that too. In addition to being claustrophobic, then it also very like dark.
Well, and also, I mean, you never – I can't even think of a haunted house or, like, a murder house. Like, they're always this kind of gothic or Victorian because mm-hmm. I feel like it's so prone to the dark paneling and the darkness mm-hmm. because it's even – the house has to be dark and overstuffed and stifling because it's just a subliminal thing, I feel like.
Yeah. But yeah, overall, I think the book was effective. Like, you know, like I know you've said that you're not the biggest fan of like gothic horror, like in literature. But like for me, I found it a relatively easy read comparatively. For me, it felt a little bit like when I read The Turn of the Screw, which we'll get to and I'll get to reread when we do Bly Manor at some point.
But, and I'll read it for the first time, like most things.
But like that book really terrified me. And I feel like a lot of gothic horror that I read, I'm too busy going, wait, what did they just say? And what just happened? Uh-huh. And let me look up that vocabulary word because I feel like I'm not visualizing it right because I'm not sure if I'm thinking what the word actually means. And I didn't have to do that as much with Hill House.
That is true.
As with some of the other ones. I felt like it was far more accessible to me.
Like A House of the Seven Gables, I remember like being so excited to read. And I still have no idea what House of the Seven Gables is about. I know I read it.
I feel that way with a lot of them. So that like that's the thing. Like I read this I listened to it and then I decided I wanted to read it again. And I feel like on reading it on paper versus reading it, you know, by listening to it, I feel like I'm getting a lot of different things out of it. Some things that are standing out to me that didn't, and some things that stood out to me before upon listening aren't jumping out. Like it's a very different experience to hear it, like as a ghost story, as someone reading it to you versus, you know, sitting in your bed and like flipping through the pages and reading it. It's all a very different reading experience. And I like both of them. Like I don't have a preference, but just been an interesting experience going back and rereading something on paper that I'd listened to originally.
And I definitely want to talk about the end of the book, but I also think that that'll probably be a more effective thing to talk about as we go through the series, which also kind of leads us to the fact that we are going episode by episode through this, but because everything is so interconnected, you know, this is a warning that there may be some spoilers for other episodes if you're watching along with us.
Yeah, the timeline, you know, as we have both seen the entire series several times, I think it's nearly impossible to talk about it without spoiling it. But I think the other thing is because of the storytelling format, because a lot of it is told in flashback and the timelines kind of overlap and things like that, it's definitely going to be difficult to not speak about some of it in context of what happens later. So be forewarned. But also, if you are listening to a podcast called The Flanacast and you have never seen Hill House, I would like to talk to you and find out how that happened. So
you sound like you're going to send everyone a pamphlet.
Yeah, just for market research purposes, I'm going to be that gal with the clipboard approaching you if you fall into that category. And also, we're biweekly. You can definitely watch the entire series by the time we release the next episode. It is a quick watch. It is 10 episodes. They're an hour apiece. And it's great. And the interesting thing, you know, just thinking about the length of it and such, this series is pretty unique even for Mike Flanagan because it is the first series he did. It is 10 episodes that were all mainly written and also directed by him. And so he viewed this really as a 10-hour movie. If you listen to the commentary track on episode one of the Blu-ray of Hill House, he discusses how stressed he was doing this. And this, as much as everyone who is a fan of his loves Hill House, it's one he has a hard time thinking of and remembering because it nearly killed him.
This week, we will be discussing episode one of The Haunting of Hill House, which is entitled
Stephen Sees a Ghost.
Thank you.
My overzealousness. And as we said before, it is written by Mike Flanagan and directed by Mike Flanagan. He came to do this by pitching this idea to Netflix and other said production companies. They asked him to give a pitch and he said, I don't know how you do Hill House better than they did it in the 60s, but if you were to, it would have to be a remix.
And a remix it is.
It is a remix, right? Stephen is not a character that exists in the source material. And yet here we are, and he is the central focal point of this episode.
And while the book and the TV series differ. It does start with a direct quote from the novel.
It does.
Do you have that on your little?
I wrote it all down. No live organism can continue to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood for 100 years. This is an addition before my family moved in, and might stand 100 more. Within walls stood upright. Bricks met neatly. Floors sat firm. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone.
So good.
I love, love, love this quote. And while we are listening to those beautiful words, we get some really beautiful establishing shots as well. In fact, during this, we get our very first hidden ghost.
Oh, is it the first?
It is the first. He's hiding. It's a little face hiding in the main staircase.
Yeah, he loves a staircase one. Oh, I did of the ones on IMDb, but like, did you see him or?
Oh, no, I went through and I literally have pictures of my television of everywhere I found a ghost. I don't know if there are more because he does say that however many you tell him you found, he'll always say there's one more. So Lord knows. But I will be keeping track of that. I will be maintaining a little Instagram hidden ghost scorecard.
I was about to say, do we have a sound effect for hidden ghosty?
Hidden ghosts. No, like a sting.
I think we could do it. Hidden ghosty.
All right. Well, there we go. I'm going to lift that. And that's going to go in everywhere you see one. Yeah, so that, and then we get the time card of Hill House then, but not
which
a year.
I love is always then. It's mm-hmm. now, it can be whenever. I mean, that's the great thing about our Mikey Flan.
We're just going to keep doing Mikey Flan here. Oh, man.
I'm sorry if you're listening. You're probably not.
Thank God he's not. So young Stephen is sleeping then in Hill House, and his character is named in honor of Steven Spielberg. Amblin did produce this. Without Steven Spielberg, we don't have Mike Flanagan's Hill House. So what a nice little tribute. And he wakes up to crying. And of course, the elder sibling in me is sitting here watching, shaking my head.
Of course.
Oh, man. And oh, the creepy statues he passes by as he goes to Theo's room.
Well, he goes to the twins' room, right?
Yeah, he's going to the twins' room. He finds Theo in the hallway. That's right. That's who, because I was like, I have Theo in my notes. And she's going like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's the general Theo energy.
The general
that I love.
Theo energy. And so, you know, he's going into the twins' room. I wrote Steven as brother parent.
Yep.
And Theo's like, should we just wake mom and dad? And he's like, I've got it. Older brother.
It's fine.
Older, I've got this. And a young Stephen is played by Paxton Singleton. So I noted that the room that the twins sleep in is blue, which is Nell's room color in the book. I am earmarking that to myself, essentially, because as we watch through the series, I would like to see if any of the other room colors correspond to any named characters. It's my theory that they might, but
they probably
can't guarantee it. But I am going to check.
Well, is Theo's Luke's room ever mentioned what color their room is? The boys' rooms aren't as
well. So Luke is in Nell's room, so that's blue. In the book, Luke sleeps in the pink room.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, they moved him into Nell because of the twin thing. But I would like to, we didn't see Theo's room in this yet.
And but we will.
Yeah, we will. And we didn't really see the walls of Hugh and Olivia aren't original characters, so we wouldn't need to know their room color. We'll just check it out. It's like a tiny, silly little detail that's just something that my brain will get stuck on because it does. So Nellie is scared.
Eleanor is scared of the bent neck lady.
And the second I heard that originally, I still remember the chill that I got of just that thought. Mm-hmm. And Steve tries to comfort her. And he's like, you know, I get scared sometimes as well, you know. And then he asks, why is Luke awake? But you heard the crying from the hallway. Maybe I'm awake because my sister's crying in the bed next to me.
I mean, that's such a brother-dad question.
Yeah, but Luke insists it's because of the twin thing. He's awake because Nellie is. So we get that first reference to the twins kind of having a joint experience. And then I wrote, oh, my God, this cute little nugget with his glasses and the Ninja Turtle pillowcase that I definitely also had.
He's so cute. All of these kids are great, but young Luke is kind of my favorite. Little Nellie is really cute too.
Yeah, little Nell is played by Violet McGraw and little Luke is played by Julian Hillard. So just a shout out to those young actors who are probably not even young. If we saw pictures of them now, we would probably
I looked at their IMDb and I was like, oh no, I can't look at that of little Nell. She does not look that sweet and innocent anymore.
I don't need to know that. No. But then suddenly behind
Real Dad comes.
Real Dad shows up. And he's like, her again? It's like, oh, man, what the fuck is going on here?
You know? You have too many kids, sir.
And so he asks where the bent neck lady was. And he suggests that Steve, big brother, you know, brother dad must have scared her away. Because big brothers are good like that. You know, way to put the pressure on an eldest sibling. Okay.
Yeah, we're about to say this is not your therapy session, Dina.
It's going to become that. So he says, guess everybody can go back to bed now. And like, all right, let's nothing to see here. Just the bent neck lady.
Well, and I like the way he describes dreams, though, that like sometimes our dreams spill over and kids' dreams are so big that like they have a bigger spill, which I think is a good way to describe
He likens the kids' dreams to like an ocean, and that's why they spill so much. And so he says, don't worry about it. The bent neck lady is just a little spill. And of course,
they're like, how long we got to stay here, bro?
And that's where we really get the exposition, you know, the first of the exposition that they are house flipping. And so as soon as the house is fixed and sold, they'll be able to move on just like the other houses before them. And so as he's closing that door and heading back to his room, he hears Shirley talking in her sleep.
And Shirley is the oldest daughter, is just behind Stephen in age. Mm-hmm. And a nod to Shirley Jackson, of course.
Yes, indeed. A nod to Shirley Jackson, played by Lulu Wilson. So this is one of those people who has now jumped from Ouija to this. Also worth noting, the person we did not name was Hugh Crane, being played by Henry Thomas, you know, who is one of the anchors of the Flanniverse.
An MVP.
MVP. So she's saying dancing in the red room. So now again, we're getting another thing where it's like, what are these children eating before bed? You know, you've got the bent neck lady, you've got dancing in the red room. And then one of my favorite little chuckles, which he's like, you're dreaming, Cheryl, like cut it out. And she goes, pandas aren't dreaming. Pandas don't eat macaroni. And I just love that. So cute.
It's true.
Pandas don't eat macaroni. She's 100% accurate. And he says noted, which I wrote down for some reason. So as he shuts her door, he notices that Nell and Luke's door is open again, which is actually a nod to the book.
Mm-hmm. The door is always open.
Mm-hmm. No matter what happens, if the door was open before, it is shut now. If it is shut before, it's open now. So that is just a cute little nod to the source material. And so then we cut to Hugh getting back into bed with Olivia, his wife. She goes by Liv. Again, one of those things we're going to have to get used to is that no character really fully goes by their actual name.
I mean, that's the same as House of Usher.
Yep. So we definitely have that going on because Olivia generally is referred to as Liv.
Liv.
Of course, played by the incomparable Carla Gugino.
Our queen.
We love her.
The goat.
She's beautiful. She's talented. She's just the whole package and the real deal. We will always sing her praises. So he's updating Liv on the situation. Instead of just starting with Bent Like Lady, he eases into that. He's more talking about the pandas and the macaroni again.
I mean, and we can tell they have like a nice relationship. They mm-hmm. seem to have a nice rapport about them.
Mm-hmm. We get there is a deleted scene, which is an extended version of this scene where they are talking about how Liv can't sleep in the house. She's having trouble and how it's too quiet there and how, you know, but then sometimes the pipes are groaning and like that's a weird thing because they've replaced them with a better material. Like they're kind of talking about how things are not fully feeling right in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But also mostly during the scene, we're getting this intimacy from them. That's like something we don't fully get to see of just like the couple before the haunting happens, because really the focus of this series is what happens after the haunting.
When things go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Which is very deliberate, right? That is something that Flanagan said that he wanted to examine, which was we often get like the typical structure of a haunting film or series is they move in and everything's fine and then little by little things get bad. And he really wanted the focus to be more on, well, what happens to these families after? And that family dynamic after. So it makes sense. But he did want to include some building up to that, especially building those relationships in those characters. And Netflix was kind of like, well, but it's a pilot and you want people to continue watching. And how long can they really settle on a long, you know, one shot? Because it really is a, you know, even this scene that was cut, there's no cuts within it. It's one take. So mm-hmm. that idea of like, how long do you think people are going to focus on your story if you don't keep it moving? But we do get from the deleted scene that the contractors keep quitting and that the flip will be worth it if they can pull it off because they would be able to build their forever home from it.
But I don't know who's buying that flipped house. Like, do you think if they flip that house, they're taking all those statues out?
I don't know. I mean, the first thing I would have done is been like, these need to be sold and gone and out of here. You know, who wants a statue of a menacing man in your living room?
But, no, not great.
You know. But anyway, he was reluctant to cut that scene. Yeah. And then we cut back to the twins' room. And Nell wakes up and the door is again open because this door
doesn't yeah.
want to stay open.
Their heating bill must be awful.
So she calls out for Luke, but this time he's asleep. So she tries to lay back down. And as the shot tightens, the bent neck lady is seen in like that soft focus behind
her. I mean, is it the bent neck lady? It's like, is it?
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was the flapper lady because it doesn't have the hair in front of the face.
So they, in the commentary of the extended version, Mike Flanagan says that what they did was that is actually Victoria Pedretti as mm-hmm. the bent neck lady. And she's there in the background, but they wanted to obscure who she was so that you didn't know when you saw Nell who the bent neck lady would be.
Oh, I see. That makes sense.
So he says that Victoria Pedretti walking around the set looked like a Smurf because they did her makeup in such a blue tone so that she mm-hmm. blended in with the background of the room and of the lighting so that, and then with the soft focus, you really can't tell. So you really just get face. But it is supposed yeah. to be the bent neck lady, and it is in fact her, which was my question when I watched it like the 19th time.
Yeah, I had just assumed all this time that it was the flapper lady, whatever mm-hmm. her name is.
Yeah, no, it's always the bent neck lady that's following mm-hmm. Nell. She's never not there, essentially. And then we get the smash cut to the beautiful sweeping music of that credit sequence. The cracking statues.
And some editing that, like, it looked cutting edge at the time, but now, like, 5 years later, looks kind of dated. It's weird how quickly technology goes.
It's interesting, too, because it almost feels like they copied and pasted some of the idea for the sequence for the crown opening. in a weird way. It's like that same, those same pans of the details of something. So in The Crown, it's obviously of like the crown jewels, but here it's the screaming and breaking statues, but it definitely feels very similar.
Yeah. It's kind of like the same person did all of the Netflix like intros for like that year.
And then also just kind of copy their own papers, but changed a few words.
Yeah.
From one semester to the next.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Updated the joke slightly.
I do like that that the idea of like showing like the maze within the house. I feel like that's very commonly associated with Hill House. And then of course pulling out to that very significant red door, because could you have anything else be the final symbol you present anyone with on the credits? So we now have the interview with Irene. The widow.
Good old Irene. Mm-hmm. Irene is really getting her health weeks in Georgia filming this.
I mean, she was in A League of Their Own. She's in Bob Hart's Abishola.
Oh, was she?
Yeah. So this is Sahida Arika Ekulona. Mm-hmm. So she is actually a very seasoned performer.
I mean, she's amazing.
She's incredible. And the wild thing about her performance is you don't even get how amazing it is from the cut that ended up on Netflix. Because in the deleted version, it is a full one shot that very, very slowly pans in on her face with nothing cutting away, and it's longer.
Oh, yeah. I saw that I haven't watched the additional deleted scenes, but I saw that was longer in the original
material. And Netflix again was like, can the audience really stay on that for that long? And this is not a story that's integral to the rest of the plot. And, you know, you're spending all this time without seeing the main focus of your episode and your main character. You're like one of your protagonists from the series. So they had like deliberately filmed later on cutaways to the phone memo running and to his hand scribbling and stuff like that. But all of that was done essentially to appease that they had to cut down this monologue, and they didn't have any coverage to cut from.
Okay.
So they filmed like almost at the end of filming these B-roll components in order to cut down her monologue.
That's interesting. That's sad, but I can actually understand. I mean, it's 10 hours, and as great of a monologue as it is, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with Hill House itself.
Yeah, but I think I prefer the version with it. Like, I think in the future, if I'm watching it, I'll probably watch the Blu-ray version. This episode is not that much longer for it. But anyway, so Irene is describing how her husband died in a tragic car accident during a storm. And she describes this whole thing about how, like, he's hanging from his seatbelt and his arm is broken. Like, it's like heart-wrenching.
Yeah, and he can reach the horn, but he can only do it for a certain amount of time before, he would tire out. And that's how he died.
Yeah. So by the end of this monologue, we then cut to Stephen, who is the person interviewing her. And this is a nod to Casablanca, who Mike Flanagan cites that is one of his favorite films. So the idea of like seeing the character after, you know, focusing on somebody else.
Oh, I would have never thought of that as a Casablanca, but I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. And so Stephen is played by Mikhail Huisin, who was the first person cast as Stephen. And so then everyone kind of had to get placed around him. And you may know him from Game of Thrones. And he has not been in anything from Mike Flanagan before or since. And then I said, why do I feel like Michelle will make a quip about the mental image of a man with a car horn for a voice?
I kind of was like, ugh, this dude, every time. Because this entire thing, him at work, is just so mansplainy. You know, it's like.
No, but I meant that when Irene is talking about how she sees her husband and every time he opens his mouth to talk to her is a ghost. He gets
is a ghost. Is a car horn. Oh my God. Lost opportunity. I was too taken by her performance. But yeah, that is the sound I hear when most men talk. It's kind of like the adult version of the Peanuts adult.
It's the feminist version of the Charlie Brown teacher.
Yeah, that's, okay, look, I was late to the quip, but I caught up quickly. That's what matters, it. Right?
You're always there. Always right there. So Stephen asks to sleep in the haunted room to conduct his investigation, and that's when he notices all of his books on the shelf, and no, there is not a copy of Midnight Mass there. Trust me, I checked.
Do you think that that's there all the time, or do you think she was like, he's coming over, I want to like show him that I have the whole collection?
I don't know. She seemed kind of embarrassed when he notices that they're there.
But she's such a good actress. Maybe it's like, oh, that old thing.
I don't think the character is a good actress, Michelle. I think she's just a human being.
God, she's good.
But as I was noticing the titles, one jumped out at me. The Haunting of Williamsburg? What the fuck?
Honestly, there's a lot of things haunting Williamsburg. Normal rent prices. Probably cupcake shops.
A lot of vape shops.
Uh-huh. Now that they're replaced by dispensaries. There's a lot of spooky things.
Weren't the cupcake shops also replaced by dispensaries?
Probably. Everything in New York.
Williamsburg is not haunted anymore. It's just one giant dispensary.
That's pretty much it.
No, that's not the fog of a ghost. That's just vape. So she mentions now, finally, that she's a fan of his books, and she quotes Hill House to him and asks what it was like to live there, and then you see from his face, like, she's like, oh, God, we got to do this again.
Ugh.
Yeah, and he confesses he's never seen a ghost. He, you know, just published.
Why would you admit that? Wouldn't you be like, yeah.
To a fan of all things.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it just seems like it's kind of
where she'll be like, thanks, I'll never buy a book again. All right, thanks, dude. Anyway, he also states he never found, like, a reason. Like, I don't, you know, houses have to be haunted for a reason. I've never found a reason. And so then she's, like, babbling on, asking about his siblings, and she's requesting a book from his father. And so his phone goes off, and it's Nell.
Mm-hmm. And he does not answer it.
And we get a flashback to Nell with her mom and dad, you know, asking to sleep in the living room back in Hill House.
I like how she thinks that this room is less scary than her room, where it seems honestly infinitely more scary. There's more statues in that room than, like, why did she think this was going to be an improvement?
I don't know. My other question about this was, why is Olivia wearing, like, beautiful formal, like, dress shoes in the living room?
I did notice that too. I was like, boo, you don't have your shoes off? Like, it's very confusing.
And not only does she not have them off, they're like evening wear shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we cut to Olivia and Nell have fallen asleep. Liv's shoes are now off. They're on the floor.
Okay, very important to note. Yeah,
take them off to fall asleep, just for the purpose of the minutes. And so she stirs awake and she kisses Nell on the head and heads up to bed. And that's when Nell experiences almost like a sleep paralysis. And we get the 90 degree yeah. camera tilt.
Do we have a jingle for the camera tilt too?
I don't know.
We'll have to work it out. I don't know. I'm not that musical.
So yeah, but we do get that tilt and the bear. I keep saying bear because I keep writing BNL for Bent Neck Lady, and that's also the initials for Bare Naked Ladies, the band.
Been 1 week since you haunted me.
So the Bent Neck Lady is hovering over Nell, and you just, like, you get the tendrils of hair first. It's so fucking creepy.
Mm-hmm.
What a great effect. Like, really. Just amazing. So we cut back to Nell in present day in a nondescript motel room. And now she's dialing Shirley. She's just going through everybody.
Yeah, she's going through her all of her contacts.
Mm-hmm. And so now we're in, I have no luck pronouncing this, I'm assuming, but Methuen, Massachusetts?
I think that's it.
Yeah. So there is a set of parents on a couch and a child on the floor.
A very creepy, good-looking child on the floor.
and they're in a funeral director's office. very 6 feet under, and mm-hmm. I'm not the only one noticing it, because I'm thinking it was definitely also kind of intentional, because Mike Flanagan just keeps talking about 6 feet under and like everything, including this commentary. So definitely the parallel was on purpose. And so Shirley's not taking the call from Nell because she's doing an intake along with her husband, Kevin.
I have a stupid question. I've watched this 9 times, but so do after Nell does it, she doesn't answer Nell's call. There's mm-hmm. a call in the office. Do we ever know who calls in the office?
I don't think so. I don't remember that.
Yeah. I noticed it this time, and I both of my viewings this time, and I was like, mm-hmm. I wonder if it was who it was, but if she like tried to call the office.
Maybe it was just somebody about a casket. Maybe. It was just the casket delivery people. Maybe it was a spam call asking if they wanted to sell their house. I don't know. I've been getting a lot of those lately.
is your insurance, auto insurance up to date?
Oh, yeah.
Warranty?
Their casket warranty is expiring.
I'm sorry. I should have known.
Yeah. So they're trying to talk the family into a viewing that's already been paid for because they're bad at business. Also because the son doesn't want to see. Like, the little kid doesn't want to see the grandparent.
But everyone thinks it's because, like, it'll be scary to see her in the casket.
Which is a logical conclusion.
Yeah. But in reality, he's like, I don't have to do that. She comes and looks at me every night.
Yeah. And everyone just kind of goes, okay. I feel like the reaction to ghosts by the adults in general is like very – it's not laughable in the moment. But like when you think about it, when you're not sitting in it, is very like, what the fuck?
But it is like very effective. They don't say like her eyes are bleeding. They don't mention like any deformity. But they said no. And she must be – what is it that she must
Her eyes must hurt because she doesn't blink.
Which is the creepiest mm-hmm. thing to imagine. It's very, very effective.
Yep. So subtle, because it's one of those like things that just like sits with you. Like you may not on first listen like catch that really, but then you're like, oh, wow, that's messed up.
Yeah. No.
And just a little bit of trivia. The woman on the couch is the mother of the actor who plays – young Luke.
Oh.
So Julian Hillard's mom is an actor as well, and she was on set so frequently because of her son being in the series that she was cast in this role. So
well, good for her.
They did a lot of casting on site. Well, not like that, like, hey, you there at craft service would want to be in this scene. But they definitely did a lot of casting on location and, you know, in the local areas for the smaller roles, because they were essentially like building this plane as it was taking off. Like they were filming it while it was still being finalized in terms of script format. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. That must have been very stressful as a writer director.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So this starts to make more and more sense as you learn these little trivia pieces about exactly why Mike Flanagan doesn't like talking about this experience, claims he lost 45 pounds while doing it, you know, all sorts of things. So totally get it. Mike, you're an MVP for all of this. So anyway, Nell's voicemail is, please call me. I'm worried. I'm worried about my twin brother. It's like, maybe turn that mirror on yourself. So yeah. And then we get a sign of the Harris funeral home, like a picture that's been taken, like a promotional picture that's somehow been framed and is being brought into the office.
Yeah, Mikkel is really proud of it. Like, he got it on Groupon or something, and he's like, yeah, look at this thing.
He's like, this photo's great. Let's put it in a newspaper. And, like, Shirley's looking at him like, what the hell is this thing? Why is it here? And, you know, but I thought about it because, so her married name is Harris, right? Kevin Harris, I guess. Is that a nod to Julie Harris from the 60s movie, The Haunting?
Oh, maybe.
I don't know, because he didn't say anything about it. But I was wondering. I'm wondering
aloud. Go to the Tumblr.
So I haven't found it on Tumblr yet either. I've been looking. So, you know, as Shirley's husband is hanging his brand new Groupon sign.
His Groupon sign.
You know, not even using a frame hanger. He's just putting a nail directly into a wall right next to the pre-existing nail. Doesn't even take that one out. You know, the home improvement person in me is like, ooh, don't do that. But he is hammering into the wall and it triggers a flashback to Hugh and Mr. Dudley working on the house. And Mr. Dudley's played by Robert Longstreet, another regular to the Flanifam.
Yeah, he's great. Mm-hmm. Things aren't going well. No surprise.
No, they are not. And in fact, Mr. Dudley says there's nothing easy about this house. And young Shirley's there checking in. And she's like, are you okay, Daddy? And I feel like there's just so many references to Daddy in Mike Flanagan's
film. Yeah, the daddy count is a little higher for
me. No one calls anyone Dad, Pop, Papa. It's always Daddy.
Daddy or Bust. It's the name of the episode.
Do we need a sting for that?
Daddy or Bust.
Oh, my God. So, you know, Hugh notions to the fact that Mr. Dudley has discovered a skeleton key. Which he gives to Shirley, and she proceeds up a spiral staircase to the red room.
Very creepy, creepy spiral staircase.
Mm-hmm. And there is one in the movie from the 60s. There is one in the movie in the 90s, and it's described in the book as well. I feel like it's this one image that, like, everybody latches onto, which is that metal spiral staircase in a library. And it's because in the book – and I think in the movies, it also gets described as the location of some character prior to the events of the book hanging themselves.
Yeah. The companion, right? Yes. That inherits everything.
Yes. So the companion who was living there with the person who inherited Hill House, there was kind of like a contentious family situation by which one of two sisters inherits the house. And that one is single and doesn't have any other family to take care of her. And so she takes a companion in from town who afterwards eventually meets her demise on the staircase. So allegedly this skeleton key is a master key that's supposed to open any room in the house, but the key is not working. And Nell indicates that she has witnessed movement in the room. Mm-hmm. So she's confused as to why the door won't open. She's seen a shadow.
So she thinks it's a pony.
Yeah,
obviously a pony.
It's a pony. It's definitely a pony. And Shirley says, this room has been locked for years and years and years. Duh. Very Shirley of her. The key does not work. Shirley bangs on the door. That's important later because we will wrap around to someone hearing that bang. But the two head off looking for more keys. And we, as the audience, now see the movement for ourselves. So the interesting thing is that as she's running away, Nell says, we need more keys. It's an emergency. And then immediately after, when we're in the present, Steve is talking to Shirley about Nell's calls. And he says, literally, everything is an emergency.
Everything is an emergency. Mm-hmm.
So it's just one of those things in which Mike Flanagan is just so brilliant about his dialogue, especially when dealing with two timelines that are running.
We go back to adult Shirley, who calls Stephen, asking him to deal with Nell, because we realize that Stephen is in the California area. Nellie is as well. And then Theo and Shirley are in Massachusetts, where Hill House is, and their father is in Florida.
Yes.
So, oh, and Luke
of course
is,
he is.
Luke, yeah. And Luke is in rehab in California, in L.A.
Yes. So, you know, Shirley is explaining to Stephen on this phone call that she sounded rough. And there's this debate, which everyone seems to be having, over whether or not Nell needs to be taken seriously. Especially when they're talking about Luke and the fact that he's not picking up his phone. And Nell is concerned about him for some reason. And, you know, they're basically giving us exposition as to the fact that Luke is probably still in rehab.
You know, hopefully.
It's not their business. Hopefully, maybe he sold his phone. So we get that there's some trouble there. And that might be the issue with Luke. So there's definitely some older sibling resentment. I will not go into it. I will discuss it with my therapist later. And Steve is now off the phone and with Irene setting up his equipment.
And mansplaining to the extreme. And he does mention, did you clock the eclipse talk?
Oh, yes, yes.
He does mention the eclipse, a hotbed issue this month.
I did think about, like, I was, as we were watching it, I was like, oh, wow. You know, some people would have thought that this was a god or whatever. Well, because they didn't know what it was. So he talks about the difference between supernatural and preternatural and this whole mansplaining rant, as Michelle said. And I love Irene's response, which is, so does it capture that?
Yeah. Which really, thank you, Irene, because that's exactly what I would say after all that.
Precisely.
With a heavy sigh.
Precisely. And of course, there have been a lot of phone calls happening in the series so far, which Mike Flanagan commented on in the commentary, just of note that he feels that phones ruin everything in a scene. He tries to remove them from whatever he's doing because usually your conflict can be solved fairly easily. And also it's just not very interesting to look at. But unfortunately, the characters had to be disparate at this point. So he's kind of stuck. There is a version of this idea where you didn't know that they were related until basically the very end of this episode, but it didn't play as well in his brain, like as he started to map it out.
I think you would need to know.
Yes, it was definitely.
There's too much family stuff. Yeah. You need to know it's about family from the beginning.
Yes. So Steve contacts the rehab center again on a cell phone. He's talking to Paige. I don't know. There's no relation to the text or any other source material that I could find. And he tries Nell's cell phone, updates her via voicemail that Luke is fine and he's getting his 90-day chip today, and says, listen, I'll be around tomorrow if you still need to chat. And then we hop to the bar.
The club.
The club in Boston, Massachusetts. We see a martini being grasped by gloved hands and Theo looking like a total snack.
Oh, my gosh.
Damn, girl.
A Lunchable without the lead. Are you a Lunchable? Because I feel a little crazy from the lead.
Are you a Lunchable? Because I just got yelled at for the sodium in my blood work. All right. So a guy is checking her out. She's not interested. She spots lady across the room. I love that little fake out.
Yeah.
I do love this little bit where, like, the girl thinks that she's gone and then she's like closer. I just swoon. Anyway. And she's like, hi, I'm Theodora. Which is the last time you ever hear that name.
That you ever hear her say, you know, no, there are other times, I think.
That they call her Theodora? No.
Only I think Theo. So.
We'll have to see.
I think there are. All right. Well, you know, I dare say we'll find out.
We'll do a count. We'll make a scorecard. I love it. So they dance. And so then they go home together.
I mean, also, I love that basically if you're like hooking up with someone from a club, she takes her gloves off and like dances with her with the gloves off, because we come to realize that she can like see, you know, other people's memories and stuff. So like, what a great way to figure out if someone's a creep or not.
Yeah. It's like, do I want to take you home? Let me just touch for 2 seconds with consent, of course. So, you know, Trish, played by Levi Tran, you know, she's obviously very satisfied, a satisfied customer. She asks, where'd you come from? And as she starts to try to find out more about Theo, she gets iced out and the gloves go back on.
Mega.
The gloves go back on. There's a germaphobe thing where it's like, oh, thanks, none taken. And then we get the iconic, I have to work tomorrow early.
Early, yeah.
And she leaves her phone number, which does have a 617 area code, so accurate. I don't know why I would notice something like
Thank you.
But
wow.
I guess I did.
You really did it.
Yep. So she sees her out and you know, the Trish is still like, what the fuck is happening here? Was it something I said? She's like, nope, we just did what we came here to do. Ice, baby.
Yeah. Good for her.
So as Trish heads to her car, she has an awkward run-in with Shirley, which is also hilarious. And then, of course, Theo, who may still have to work early tomorrow, may not, heads out to the porch with Shirley for a few beers.
For a beer and gloves.
For a beer and gloves, yes. She wears the gloves. Like somehow the factory worker at whatever beer company it is like going to leave their memories on it for her. I don't know. Got it. So, yes, apparently the exterior of Shirley's house slash the funeral home is a like wedding venue and museum. And the interior of it was used for where Nell's wedding is, which is interesting because I always thought Nell's wedding was held at Shirley's house.
I think I did, too.
But in Mike Flanagan's mind, they're two different locations. But we just picked up on the fact that the architecture was similar.
It's probably the same.
Yes. So, you know, that's where we get that Theo is not going to see or doesn't plan on seeing Trish again. She's sweet enough, but she's got a pile of issues. And it's interesting because Kate Siegel, who plays Theo, really fought for like this arc for her character. And the thing I know that you've talked about that I also agree with that has always struck me about this is just how, you know, Theo's queerness is not necessarily integral to the plot in any way. It's just there.
Yeah, it's just a fact.
Mm-hmm. It's just a fact. It's a reveal, but it's not like a big deal. It's all handled like very like this is just part of the fabric of their family and their character. And yeah, so I'm here for that. I love it.
But we do find out that Theo and Nell do not have a great relationship right now because they haven't talked since L.A. when Shirley mentions the phone call.
Yes. And she says, because she's like, well, she sounded bad.
My favorite, yeah.
Again, she sounded bad. Like, if Shirley cares so much, call her back. But no, she's just calling everyone else going, did she call you? She sounds bad. And then she gets the reaction from Nell that you love.
Which is, she says that Nell has one a foot in crazy and the other on a banana peel, which honestly, I want on my grave.
And then she says, well, I'm drawing boundaries and you should do the same. So, yeah. Shirley admits that the call scared her and, you know, we get a little bit more of the exposition from Theo that Luke's going to show up at some point when he needs money or whatnot, like he has before. And, you know, that concern Shirley has, which is, but what if one day it's not that? What if one day we're expecting he will show back up and he doesn't? That little fear that keeps you from drawing the boundary. So a little bit of reveal about their feelings. And that brings us to Jacksonville, Florida, present day.
Beautiful. Beautiful Jacksonville, Florida.
And Hugh Crane's asleep. It's 1:37 a.m. And we get a little bit of a scare because we get that arm around him, Little Spoon style, touching his face. But as he turns around, the face doesn't quite read as like normal to me.
Like, it's ghosty, but then it's a dream.
Yes, it is a dream. But what I'm saying is like, I couldn't figure out, I was like, who is this actor? Is that Carla? Like, he doesn't mention it in the commentary. I was hoping he would say like, oh, we used a different actor, so it wasn't quite familiar. Or, you know, we did this special effect. Like, it's something in the uncanny valley for me that they did to the face that I wish I could identify like what it is. But anyway, that's just me. Apparently this scene was day one of a 100-day production schedule.
Oh, all right.
And as he wakes from this nightmare, his phone is ringing and it's Nell, and she's really in crisis now. And she says very quietly, do you remember the bent neck lady? And that gets his attention. He's like, yes. And he tells her, she tells him she's back. And he's very like, he does that calm parent thing, right? Like, okay.
Yeah, which is like really scary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me what's going on. Like, where is she? You need to go to Stephen Lee's. He's the closest. I'm coming. Like, literally throwing stuff in a bag as he's responding and talking to her. And then you get that really just chilling, like, okay, I'm sorry I woke you. I'm going to go now. Bye. Which is never a good sign. And she steps out of the car and heads toward Hill House.
So she's somehow not in L.A. like her father thinks. Mm-hmm. She is, in fact, in Boston.
Mm-hmm. And all the lights are on in Hill House, even though the place is boarded up. And then we get, you know, Hugh talking to somebody as he's reaching for the doorknob. So we find out later that he still talks to Liv, even though she's no longer with us. So we flash back to then, another time where Hugh is launching into action. These transitions become very commonplace in the series. It's a hallmark of the structure. And he's waking up Stephen, We get a hidden ghost in silhouette behind Steven in his room that's there like the whole time. There's like a shadow of like a guy standing there. It's almost like very – this one's like very Slenderman in terms of like the appearance.
Yeah, they're all very different.
Yeah, they're all very, very different. And so Hugh is checking the hall. He shuts the door. He locks it. We get that doorknob twist that is very
– it turns so many times. It's also the creepiest doorknob
in the world. It's like a lion or something. I think all of them pretty much match, too. Like, they're all the same creepy doorknob.
None of them are right.
Yeah.
None of them are from a Lowe's, let me tell you.
And this is basically, like, a direct quote to you know, the book. Like, that doorknob turning and the banging on the door. Apparently, when they were filming this, nobody had any idea what was on the other side of the door. That had not been discussed. They had not really gotten that far in like writing that reveal. So neither Henry Thomas nor anyone working on it knew what was on the other side. They just had to pull off that and somehow Hugh Crane knew, and he does that beautifully. So a testament to his performance. So as
carries Steve out, he carries him out.
He tells him to keep his eyes closed no matter what. And as they're running through the house, you know, you get the statues and all that stuff that you're passing by. But then we see like what may be Olivia, but she's moving oddly, come around a corner. And as they're descending the like main grand staircase, we get three hidden ghosts at the bottom of the staircase.
Yeah, that one I did have in the IMDb.
Yeah, one is on the left and two are on the right. And you actually never really fully see them at the same time. Like the one on the left is way clearer, and then all of a sudden it's the other two that are clearer. But they run out the door, they pile into the station wagon, not a seatbelt to be found, and the kids are screaming and crying, and it's really like upset. Like they really do a good job at creating this.
No,
like,
the kids
trauma,
are really good.
This like chaotic trauma. They're really good. And where's mom? And then Luke says, I saw Abigail in the window upstairs, which is obviously meant for all of us to be like, who the fuck is Abigail? And we,
yeah, you know, exactly.
We won't see her in this episode, although we kind of technically do. And
I see a picture of her.
Mm-hmm. And then the scariest one is, you know, where's mom? Where's mom? I think I see mom. That's not mom.
Yeah. You know, something really bad has happened.
Uh-huh. And then they peel away. And Steven does see someone in the window. But, you know, they're like, we can't leave mom. And in present day, Hugh is telling Steve via the phone to go home to stay with Nell. But obviously he's out ghost hunting and he's not even living at home right now. So he's like, bye. And so he drifts asleep in the haunted room of Irene's house.
Meanwhile, we see back in Hill House, I have Nell dancing through life.
She's dancing through the house, which is a scene from the book. You know, it's that, you know, really chilling kind of final experience where, you know, Nell seems to have like broken with reality. You get it in the 60s version. I think there's some version of it in the 90s one, although not nearly as memorable, obviously. And that's where we get the Oculus mirror.
Yep.
And that nice little reflection shot of her dancing. And as we cut away from that, Theo is asleep. It's 3:02 into 3:03 a.m. And she jolts awake. We get another shot of Shirley jolting up. And she says, Nellie's in the red room. And then Luke jolts up. And now all of them are kind of rubbing their necks. And even Steven jolts awake at 12:03 because he is dealing with a time difference. And he awakes, and then there's the droplets of water on his face. So this idea of them all being interconnected to this moment.
Yeah, but only Shirley says Nellie's in the red room because she's the one that tried to get in the red room with her.
So as Stephen is investigating this leak, a near collision happens at the intersection outside of the window, screeching wheels, honking horns. So that leads us to, it is now morning and Stephen is actually guying, debunking everything about the haunting that Irene is experiencing.
we get a good quote about ghosts. Yeah.
Yeah. We get that really lovely speech about all the things a ghost can be, you know,
a ghost is a wish is how it ends. And it's, It's very, you know, it's a nice sentiment in the middle of.
Yeah, it's quite poignant. And he's saying this as he's signing a copy of the book. And I paused it to read the inscription. He says, "To Irene, thank you and Carl for your support. And whatever walked there walked alone." Original. So original.
Yeah. It's probably what he writes in every single book.
100%. He has a rehearsed signature and that's it. So, you know, we get a flashback to Shirley slamming the manuscript of The Haunting of Hill House down on the table. And Mike Flanagan says it was a very controversial choice in terms of like debating whether or not the title of Stephen's book should have been The Haunting of Hill House. You know, like, do they dare to say that Shirley Jackson's book doesn't exist in this universe? But I guess since it doesn't, it makes perfect sense. And so she's pregnant at this point in the timeline.
Which is a clever way to like add one more timeline, but mm-hmm. it'd be a very specific thing.
Mm-hmm. And she's just like, the fuck, Steve? And they're at Stephen Lee's house and she's objecting to the contents of the book. And she says he raped the family. And like, that just shows just how much betrayal, you know, that she's experiencing of their story being out there. Lee's trying to mediate Samantha Sloan.
Not very well.
In one of her nicest roles.
I was about to say, never again has she been this sympathetic.
I know. But she's only sympathetic here. Like, really, ultimately, we get to see a whole lot more color from her character, mm-hmm. from the character of Lee. Like, you know, but we do see those shades of like, oh, come on. It's my family, too. Let's be nice here. You know, so very, very not, you know, what we normally associate with her, I guess. And so, you know, Stephen is saying to Shirley that mom was mentally ill, and then he accuses the apple of not falling far, which is wild to say to Shirley of all of the siblings, you know.
I don't think he's saying it. I don't think he's saying it to her. I think he's saying it about Nellie, or maybe because also I forget where in her marriage, like if she was happily married then or where we are in that. But he's saying it because we realize later on that, like, he doesn't want to have kids. So he's saying it to him, but then he realizes he's saying it to a pregnant woman. So, yeah. so it cuts even worse.
Yeah, it was, like, one of those weird ones where I was just like, but what would make you even want to say that to her? Like, just so much of it was just like, dude, just stop talking. And, you know, he apologizes because I guess he realizes way too late what we all realized way before that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no one's buying the novel, Cheryl. And she says, well, if you publish it, you know what it costs. So then we cut to Steve seeing that he wants to offer Irene that he'll tell Carl's story. And he's like, you know, he was a fan. Like, I'll make it nice.
I'll make it nice. Thank you for using that voice.
I'll make it nice, you know. I'll do it justice. I'll do it real respectful. He'll, you know, it'll honor his memory, you know.
Okay. Thank you.
So, yeah. So we cut to young Hugh because we don't want to refer to older Hugh as older Hugh because Mike Flanagan made that mistake once when talking to him about his character. And he was like, what? I'm the old one?
You are the old one, though.
Yes. But after that, they refer to him as Hugh Crane and young Hugh Crane as young Hugh. So young Hugh is with a lawyer and Steve and saying, nobody saw anything. My children won't have to take the stand. And we find out that essentially there haven't been legal charges. Like, everyone has, in fact, ruled that Olivia died by suicide, but that there is a family court matter of whether or not Hugh is fit to maintain custody of his children or whether they'll go to Aunt Janet.
And it hasn't helped that he's talked to all these tabloids.
Mm-hmm. And basically said, I believe the house was haunted. So, you know, they're basically questioning his fitfulness to keep his children. So he's insisting, I don't care what has to happen. I don't care if they, you know, if family court thinks I'm crazy, the house has to stay closed. You know, I maintain that this house is dangerous. And I will not backpedal on any of that. So they're saying, well, you could raise money for the legal bills if, like, you let tours go in or whatever. And he's like, absolutely not. Definitely not that. And he says, I want the gates and the doors kept locked at all times. And I want to know every day that it's empty. Except for the Dudleys. The Dudleys stay on. It sits there and rots.
Mm-hmm. which it seemingly has, although the electric sound's still on, the ghosty electric is still on.
The ghosty electric is still going. So back in the car with younger Steven, he apologizes that his son had to hear all of that. And then we cut back, we bounce back to Steven in a car again, but now he's the older Steven calling Lee from the car.
And she ain't happy.
She's not happy. You know, and he's trying to warn her that Nell may show up at the house today because, you know, he didn't get a chance to explain the situation to his family.
I guess in like rewatching this, at this point, has Luke already been to the house or does that happen after he calls?
I think timeline wise, it's hard to tell because she doesn't really let on either way.
Either way.
But I'm going.
I mean, it would have to be before, but you would think that she would at least be like, oh, wrong twin.
But maybe not. Well, it depends on how far he's living from where their house is.
That's true.
Because it's not nightfall yet. So
yeah, that's true.
So if he was showing up there, he shows up at her house at nightfall as well. I don't think it's been a full day.
So oh, that makes sense.
So
yeah,
my imagination is there. Right. He's going to show up not too long after this. And she's just like, why the hell is this happening? I told you guys to stay away from me. And like, there's this little bit with like, you mean my house? The house, like his denial of like wanting to address any of this. And, you know, you get the, is that all? And he's like, well, maybe I can come by. And she says, you know what you'd have to say. Is there any point?
Yeah.
And she hangs up on him right after that. So we're back to then in Hill House and we get our introduction to Mrs. Dudley.
The wonderful Annabelle Gish.
Mm-hmm.
What a pro.
Playing a truly iconic character, right? Mrs. Dudley, almost like I feel like one of the more parodied characters in like other horror, you know, situations.
Well, I also feel like there's nothing more gothic than like Daphne du Maurier. Like there's nothing more gothic than like a very, very stern, like kind of queer coded housekeeper. Cause in Rebecca, it's the same, she's the same character from Rebecca, really.
Yep. And this idea of like how stern and severe and like stoic she is. And you know, that in the book, it repeats a couple of times, like no one comes here. Even the villagers won't come here in the dark, in the night. And like Theo makes fun of her in the book. Like,
I mean, they all make fun of her in the book. They don't really make fun of her in the series.
No, not in the series, not in the 60s version so much. In the 90s one, Catherine Zeta-Jones's character does make fun of her. But I mean, listen, this is really a far more complex and layered version of her. I feel like in the source material, Mrs. Dudley is a character who basically sets out food and reminds them that they are there alone.
And Mr. Dudley has no, like really nothing.
No,
like
there's that very scary really, scene with him at the gate.
That's true.
In the book where he's intimidating everyone.
But besides that, that's really the only time you see him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time you see him.
Yes. And here he's kind of made to be the more sympathetic of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Although you do get those layers peeled back on Mrs. Dudley and like why she does what she does and says what she says and all of that.
But in this scene, she is giving Stephen the third degree.
Oh, yes, she is. And, you know, he's eating a sandwich and she's
arranging dishes, which is a nod to the book.
Yes. Except in this case, she's arranging them to sell them. And while she's arranging the dishes and he's just trying to eat his sandwich, crunching on his chips. And she's like, have you heard the word of our dear Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ?
That's how it goes, really.
I mean, we do also get the exposition that no staff has lived on property since 1948. I also wrote in between these notes, could her cross be any bigger?
Yeah, it's practically rapper level. but she also, they also mentioned that they found like Ouija boards and mm-hmm. like, which a fun nod to
cute little
Ouija
nod. Too. Yes. We'll have to look and see if we spot any of them, if we spot any Ouija boards in the house. So we find out also that with the last family, the Hills, right? So here we get that the house was not named for the hills that they were living around, but rather an actual family named the Hills. And
we should also take note to say, if we're talking about people named for characters, mm-hmm. Hugh Crane is named for the original owner of Hill House in the book,
yes,
right?
The man who built it. Yes.
The man who built it.
Yes. And his family in the text, his family, or he builds the house for his family, but ultimately as they move in, tragedy befalls them and their family falls apart. And he wants to fill it with children, doesn't really have children. Tragic things happen to them. And his first wife dies before she even gets to see the house that he built for her. She never gets to see her dream house that was built. So that's also kind of a little bit of a nod to Olivia.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, back to this scene, because it is very intense. This is where we get the no one would live nearer than town. No one will come any closer than that. So yes, they lived all alone in the night, in the dark. We get the classic Mrs. Dudley line that is lifted almost directly from the book. And Stephen is like, okay, sandwich? No?
He's eating his chips.
Yeah. And so as Mrs. Dudley is proselytizing to him about the importance of the light of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, Olivia jumps in to be like, hell no, we are atheists.
He also knows the Quran. He knows, you know, all of these other things.
Mm-hmm. And basically she explains, I've taught my children to study all sorts of religion and such because I don't want them being sold ridiculousness. And there is a hidden ghost behind her, by the way. This one is like a little bit like a reference to the Pazuzu face. I feel like this one is very like, let's make a face up to look like the Pazuzu flash. And it's very quick.
Like that one's quick, yes. Mm-hmm.
That one's quick. If you like don't freeze it at the right time, you kind of miss it.
But then Liv asks where Luke is.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen says, he's in his treehouse. And she's like, oh, you.
Oh, very funny. So like, and basically the reveal of that aspect is like revealed so early in the series. Like episode one, you're getting that these kids are in places that aren't real. But real. You write it off because these are adults going to the children. Oh, absolutely not. It can't possibly be. And then you're just like, oh, okay, well, who's right? Like this... in a way, it's constructed to be confusing to you so you don't catch it right away, even though it's all there. It's very earned by the end because the groundwork has been so solidly laid and been there all along. So even when Stephen is actually going up into the treehouse, the barn door that is used to get in there is red.
Is red, yeah, is a red door. Yeah. I didn't even really clock that. I knew that the doors are red.
Mm-hmm. The door is red, and not only that, but then there is that very skinny rectangular window with a small crack in the bottom corner on the right. And in the treehouse, the window doesn't have a crack, but there is a twig in the same spot as where the crack would be. So there's that. And there's also an E.T. lunchbox in there.
Yes, which is a nod to...
Henry Thomas.
To Hugh Henry Thomas. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye.
So Steve is looking at all these pictures that he's been drawing because Luke is trying to make a sign that's like, He-Man, Woman Haters Club, no girls allowed.
Nothing's more 80s, 90s than that.
No, absolutely not. So, you know, he's drawing that, and Steven's looking at his pictures on the wall and sees the family and sees like the pictures get darker. And then there's a girl there that doesn't look like anybody that lives there. And he's like, oh, that's my friend.
Oh, I had imaginary friends too. She's not imaginary.
She's not. She's real. And like what we don't realize is that is our first visual introduction in a way to Abigail. She's mentioned earlier, but now we get to see somebody actually knows her. And then we get the scary person with open mouth drawing, like, which is like all this dark shit.
Is that the bent neck lady? It kind of looks like the bent neck lady, doesn't it?
I can't really tell. I was like, it's just scary. It's just creepy. It could be.
It's not great.
It could be, but you know, it's a little kid drawing it. So, you know, and he's like, where'd you get the idea for these drawings, man? Like, you want to tell me anything? But we don't get the rest of that conversation because we cut back to California. And there's actually a scene before he returns to his apartment that is cut from the Netflix version. So in the regular Netflix version, we would immediately after this see Steven getting into his apartment.
Into his apartment, yeah.
But in the extended cut, we get a deleted scene where Steven is on the road home and he drives by an accident. He sees a car accident. And so Mike Flanagan says it's one of the most expensive deleted scenes of all time because they had to shut down all the roads and they had to create like a flipped car and ambulances and medics and all sorts of things. But while he's taking the call, it's his agent. And his agent, his literary agent, Richard, is asking if anything turned up in this home visit that he did. And when he reveals mm-hmm. that nothing happened there, but he thinks he can use something about it because he looked into the history and it's a hospice or blah, blah, blah. And he's like, what if we go at this angle? What if we go at that angle? And the literary agent is like, you know what you really need to do? The world wants to know more about your family and where everyone is now. And you can make a lot more money if you do that. And Steven turns it down.
Oh.
Which is a very different character development than what we get.
Development. And what, yeah. It's actually sympathetic to him.
Mm-hmm. And that got cut because, you know, they felt like it didn't really bear to the ultimate ending or anything like that. But I think that that was a huge difference. So as he does arrive back to his apartment after that, he spots Luke looking rough.
Who is, yeah, looking rough, coming down the stairs with a bunch of his stuff.
Mm-hmm. He has his iPad. He has a fancy camera. And he looks very guiltily at Steve. And it's like, this isn't what it looks like, you know. And
which we come to find out it really isn't because he actually mm-hmm. hasn't. You know, had any drugs.
He hasn't.
Which is so sad.
I know. And he's shivering and, you know, Steve notes that. And, you know, Steve does a really kind thing. He tries to offer no judge. I mean, he probably is judging him a lot, but he tries not to judge too much. And, you know, he says, listen, you can't take my iPad. You could take the camera and resell it if you want. I have $200 cash I can give you. Like, just please, you know, don't take the iPad. And Luke obliges and apologizes and insists again that this is not what it looks like. And he even gives back the camera.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want any of it. He just takes the $200.
Yeah. So then as Steve gets back up to his apartment, he finds the lock is broken because obviously. And as he turns on the light, Nellie is there.
And which he thinks that she's just standing there letting him get robbed.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he says, did you bring Luke here and, like, watch him loot my apartment? Like, what's up with that? You know, because obviously Nell and Luke probably have one of the better or stronger attachments at this point. And so as he's launching into this frustrated rant and asking what she wants, like, she's been silent this whole time and just kind of, like, looking at him. The phone rings. And it's Hugh. And, you know, he's like, you hear very, very faintly, Nell wasn't in L.A. She's at the house. She's dead. And that's.
And he's like, no, absolutely not. She's here.
And she does this, the image of her slowly, like her eyes going opaque and her face turning gray and almost like stone like as she like mm-hmm. goes into this silent scream before disappearing. And he falls. That
blows him backwards. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the camera pulls back as we're just left with Hugh repeatedly asking Steve if he's there. End of episode.
End of episode one.
What a pilot.
Yeah, it's a great pilot. It gives us a lot of exposition. It sets a lot of stuff up. Mm-hmm. I feel like what I like about the series is that there's a really strong beginning. There's a really great middle. Because the bent neck lady episode, I feel like, is the exact middle. Mm-hmm. And then the finale, it's just such a well-crafted show.
Yeah. The thing that surprised me the most from the commentary was how it was being crafted while being filmed. And for the structure to be that fine-tuned when that's the case is, like, shocking to me.
I mean, that's when you have, like, you're a great artist, you know, you're a great collaborator, because mm-hmm. I feel like you create such a great collaborative environment, and that's when the best stuff happens, when you can, like, take from everyone and kind of, you know, mm-hmm. hear being a really good sounding board.
Yes. And also, I think having a very clear vision of what it was supposed to be and what, you know, what the remix was supposed to go like. So the idea of, like, planning out that those like particular plot points that he always wanted to be part of it. You know, obviously Nell always having been the bent neck lady, that reveal being a thing, obviously always wanting, you know, to basically the connection between Luke and Nell being something that was going to be a big reveal, all of that stuff always being in the back of the mind. So obviously those things still feel earned because they didn't just randomly make up an ending as they were writing it, as they were filming it. The outline was very clearly and specifically predetermined.
Well, I'm excited to go over these next 9 episodes, really dig in. We will maybe figure out a way to watch The Haunting, the 1999 version together. That'll be fun.
We're going to have to. It's funny. It's like, what? I mean, it's what's his face is in it? That guy with the weird voice. Owen Wilson.
Well, you could have gone a lot of ways there, but okay.
Owen Wilson is in it, and like he has a weird fate in the film. It's all weird. Anyway. Yeah, I'm looking forward to digging into this a little bit more. I'm on a ghost hunt, you know.
Yeah, we're gonna count those little ghosties for you.
Yes, especially since there's like a wild way in which that it was. They always knew they were going to have them. So basically what they would do is they had ghosts on reserve. They would make up a bunch of ghosts in the green room that would be there all day, just like hanging out at craft services. And when they would set up a shot, if they felt like there was a spot that they could hide them in where it was visible but not too visible, they would be like, hey, hold for ghosts. And they would bring ghosts in and they would there and be there and do it and like do whatever they needed to do. And then they'd be gone. So like he always just had ghosts there to place
reserve
them.
Reserve ghosts.
Yeah, it became like a game.
This is the best version of Where's Waldo that I can imagine.
Yep, so these reserve ghosts would hang out. And he says eventually it kind of worked out to be a couple of people that would just return and do it because it's a very specific thing that a lot of actors might not be willing to do, which is show up and hang out and maybe not get used or maybe something nobody
You'd
ever
still
sees
get your day
there.
Right though.
I know.
Yeah,
I would think it was fun. I would do it. Like if he was looking for hidden ghosts for his next season or something, I would. Mikey Flan,
if you're listening.
I look good in gray face paint.
Well, episode 2 will be out in 2 weeks. We are bi-monthly, right?
Bi-weekly.
That's the correct word.
Bi-monthly.
I mean, that's the same thing, isn't it?
We're bi?
Yeah, I guess.
Listen to the Flanacast. We're bi.
We're bi.
So if you liked our episode and you want to keep following along on our journey through Hill House, you can like, subscribe, rate, review. You can follow us on Instagram at FlanacastPod.
You can follow Michelle at VintageOldBiddy.
And you can follow Dina at bear.reviews.horror. And until next time, look for some ghosts.
Yeah. And until next time, count your ghosties instead of sheep.
Oh, I like that.
The Flanacast will return in 2 weeks wherever you get your podcasts. If you liked today's episode, we would love for you to rate and subscribe. It helps get our show into the earbuds of our fellow Flanafans. Join us on Instagram by following us at FlanacastPod for more content. See you soon.